Station number 15433.
Peter McAloose, side 13. Dislike of the Afrikaners.
I got on fairly well with them.
Yeah.
And I did it through a chap called Pete Botas, who was extremely kind to me. He was a captain, and I said, you know what, I better learn something about this country. And I learned quite a bit about Afrikaans history, the Battle of Majuba Hill, learning about the Ons River Volunteers, and, I actually went into it and an element of depth, so I could actually talk to them about various battles, Colenso, Spion Kop, I learned all about the Voortrekkers leaving and their battles with Shaka and Dingaan and whatnot. With Shaka. So there was an element of respect with them and me. And I think where I got it was, I said, I'm not taking shit in my life anymore. I said, I took it off some Rhodesians, I'm not taking it off South Africans now. Mm-hmm. And I dug my heels in it. And I remember one day I heard a guy saying, salt peel. Salty balls. Salt peel. That means 1 foot in England, 1 foot in Africa, and your balls in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I says, come here, son. I said, I don't know if you're aware, but I'm not an Englishman. I said, I'll tell you something. We fought the English 600 years before it even dawned on you. You know the difference is? We beat them. You didn't. I used to give them what they gave me. Can you see that? I heard one officer one day going, oh, Englishman. I says, no, Scotsman to you. A very prominent character in the Afrikaans church was a chap called Andrew Murray. I said, well, Andrew Murray was a Scotsman, So I used to just humour them and get on with it. Because they could be awkward and difficult at times, But generally speaking, I liked them,
Yeah. Did you find they had much of a sense of humour?
No, they didn't. No, they didn't. Totally. Pete Botha is one of the guys, he was very much into fauna and flora. And this guy had buckled this tree and broken it. And he went, who done that? And he's ranting and raving. So the guy's put a splint on the tree with a drip, and he looks and he says, why have they done that? they're taking the mickey out of them. But I liked the Afrikaner, and he was a study in his own. And the other thing was, you started getting enlightened Afrikaners. I met a chap called Commandant Rabi, and we used to start, and he got on about, the Ons River Volunteers and whatnot, and where his country went wrong, and where they got it wrong, so I actually enjoyed it. Right, let's go back on to Daisy again.
Okay, no, that's all right. What about the British or English-speaking South Africans, of which there aren't many in the South African Armed Forces?
Right, what actually happened at that time, the only way a Brit would get in the South African Army then, or an English-speaking South African, would be to join the Army. They were never called up because they held English passports. Then all of a sudden, when they were getting pushed, they called them all up. And there was a resentment there, in that the Afrikaner was the people, they were the people who were bearing the brunt of the war. Yeah. So there was that resentment, and I said, we're not going on like this. So they called them all up. And there was a heavy resentment against, with the English people against it. But then again, they went into a system that was loaded in favour of the Afrikaner.
But your orders were given in what language?
English.
English.
Yeah.
But outside, they're all given mostly in Afrikaans.
It used to cause an awful lot of confusion. For example, you were supposed to be bilingual. 1 week or one day you'd speak Afrikaans, the next day or the next week
you'd
speak
English. But you don't speak Afrikaans, do you?
No, but we could understand it.
All right.
In the parachute units, they refused to speak English. Can you see that? No, they wouldn't speak English.
At all.
Bilingual, and this is where the system was a bit corrupt. To be bilingual, you could speak Afrikaans with a smattering of English. You were bilingual.
Yeah.
But you couldn't speak English with a smattering of Afrikaans.
Well, you had to be good at that. At Afrikaans.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you find many Brit English speakers who had any position of authority or anything else in the South African Armed Forces?
Still, 1948, they'd done the business, and they weren't going to let it happen again. See, in 1948, they cleaned out the army. It was called the Night of the Brigadiers or something. They sacked about 10 brigadiers or 8 brigadiers in one night, never to come back. And they brought back a chap who'd been in the Assie van Branfag, during the war. and had been in prison. They put him in charge of the Defence Force. They
what was his name?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
And the other thing is the they'd done away the rank of lieutenant colonel. They called him commandants, and a lieutenant was a felt cornet. You know.
Is that right? Yeah, I didn't know that. So there were no Brits. What happened to the national servicemen who were Brits? They're English speakers. They got a rougher time if they didn't understand the language.
The funny thing is, a lot of them were actually instructing. One guy says to me, "Peter, I'm instructing Afrikaans. I don't even know what I'm saying." He says, "You know, I can talk it, but I can't break it down." And I, you know.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, he was doing it parrot fashion. And it must have been terrible pressure on them, you know.
What's the Afrikaans for "I left you in this position"?
I don't know.
But okay, I thought there was a lot of. I had the impression that there was a lot of bullying of English speaking national servicemen.
Well, I never actually witnessed it. No. But there was an awful lot of bullying went on in the South African Army.
Right.
There was. And in fact, there was a bit of it on the Rhodesian Army as well, you know.
Yeah.
I'll block some of you, and, you know. And I'd look at a guy and say, well, you better mean it, you know.
Yeah.
And they would use the rank to threaten to strike the man.
Yes, yes.
And I say, you know, are you threatening me with violence? Because if you are, let's go and do the business.
And that used to take the wind out of the sails.
Yeah. I mean, I was there one night, and there was an officer called Mark Adams who was there. And Mark was a professional soldier. And this guy started taking the mickey out of him from the parachute battalion. And the guy was a major, and he humiliated Mark. And Mark, he's not one to let his guard down. He immediately left, and this guy turned on me as the other English-speaking person in the company, and he started taking the mickey out of me. I says, "Major, you've already done it to one person. The difference between me is I will do something about it." He says, "What?" I says, "I'll beat the shit out of you."
What was his response?
He says, "Don't you talk to me like that." I says, "Major, don't you treat me like that." And straight on, you know. And once you stood up to them, they were okay.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you get into any more scraps in the...
No.
You're giving up scrapping by this time, were you? People didn't give you a hard time.
Yeah.
Bullying in the South African Army.
Yeah.
I mean, that went on a bit, or...?
They were terrible for striking people. You know, they'd throw their hand back and hit them.
Really? On parade?
No, it had never actually been done on a parade. It'd be done like in a personal, you know, backhander. And what I used to do,
just clip them.
I used to do it in an affectionate manner. I would actually say to them, I say, "Bend your head forward and go," you know, like that.
Right.
I'd hit my hand, and you know, the message was put across. Yeah. And they were terrible people for. You know, I went one day, and there's guys rolling tires. We're in an operational base, and they're rolling tires up and down this, you know, big. Armoured car tires, rolling them up and down this...
Punishment.
I says, "Why are you doing that? They've got to be punished." I says, "You're tying down a sergeant major, you're tying down the medical officer. Why don't you go and get them to dig trenches? Get them to dig, you know, rubbish pits, trash pits, anything. Get them to do something productive."
What did they say to that?
They couldn't understand it. They had this, you know, it was a British national service attitude of the 50s. That's exactly the more best way of explaining it. You know, the discipline sometimes get confused with messing people about.
How did they treat the... And they got the coloured corps there, hadn't they? Or do you see many
the Kaffirian rifles and...
Yeah.
They were always kept apart. And the one black unit that sort of everybody respected there was 32 Battalion. I mean, that was an Angolan battalion. They were recruited from UNITA.
Was that recce commando, 32?
No.
No.
There was a black recce commando, which was five reconnaissance commando, which was blacks as well. You know, Mozambicans, Zambians, Angolans.
And how did that, what was the trick? They were kept on their own, were they? I mean,
32 Battalion, yeah. But they had an awful good white leader element. Okay. I mean, the leader element in 32 Battalion were gutsy soldiers.
Did you do much work with them?
I worked with them once.
Oh.
That was in the Op Carnation.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Doing?
In actual fact, what happened is we were going to attack a camp, and I'd smashed my legs, but I'd parachuted in. I'd smashed my legs, my kneecaps, and I was going along, and I was in agony. And we had a couple of recce commando doctors with us, and he said, Peter, if you can't, you're not okay by tomorrow, I'm going to fly you. I said, don't bring a helicopter in for me. And it was, what happened is we crossed a piece of road, and we were 32 battalion, a kid stood in a landmine.
An Angolan or?
No, a white South African.
Yeah.
And the guys went to run, and I said, stop where you are. So I got my bayonet out, and the drill is you go out at 90 degrees and you prod in from the side, because they normally lay mines along the track. I got him there, and he put his two arms around me. And he started crying. He said, Sergeant Major, I'm a Springbok athlete, you know. Anyway, we got on the horn.
Yeah. Legs gone or?
He's totally feet gone. Yeah. So you get a helicopter in here, and you know, and I heard a truck coming up the road. Somebody says a truck coming. And I went there. I stood on the side of the bushes, and the guys were all lined up. I just stood at the side of the road, and the truck came by and went bump, bump, you know, right across the cab. And I put a burst into the front of the cab, and there was two on the back, and we got one in the back, and the last one was sitting with his feet up in the back, and he started running towards the front of the truck. He, in actual fact, we never got him. He got off and fired an RPG-7 rocket and hit one of the guys with a rocket.
One of the troops?
Aye.
What, caught him with an RPG?
Yeah, the rocket hit his water bottle and blew a chunk off his arse, you know.
It's lucky, that's all.
Yeah, and we got them, and then the helicopter came in. And I said to the boss, I said, I'll go out with the wounded now, you know, but... So they carried on and did a camp attack after, but I was in a bad way, you know. I get into this camp, and they gave me Sossigan, which is, you know, it's an analgesic. They never gave me Stematol with it, you know. I got violently ill, you know.
Ah, right, mm. Okay, yes. Okay, I think we're going to have to leave it there right now. Okay, Peter, right, welcome again to the Imperial War Museum. We've had about a lull of about 10 days or so since we went over your exploits, and we got to the bit where you're in South Africa, or more especially in Namibia, and grading over into Angola. And I think we got up to the place where you said that a man had been injured in a landmine explosion, and you had to shoot across the front of this vehicle, which was what SWAPO were in that.
It was a SWAPO MPLA vehicle because they were helping each other. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Can we just go on what happened after that? You were in South Africa until when?
86.
86. And you left the South African Parachute Regiment when?
I left it in the end of
84. End of 84. And then you were with a security company.
Yes, a company called Coin Security.
Right. And then you did, if I'm right, close protection 86, 87 in Uganda.
Yes.
And then you were several times off and on up until 1991 or so, three times in Colombia.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So what actually happened? How come you left the South African Defence Force? Well,
the whole time I was in the army, I always wondered how I'd fit into a civilian background. And one of my ex-officers approached me and asked me if I was interested in getting into security management. And I couldn't resist the challenge. It was, you know, although I loved the army, I couldn't see it going on forever. So I decided to come out, and I went to this company, which was a sort of paramilitary company.
Okay.
And, you know, we gathered things like national key points and whatnot. So, you know, there was still a military, you know, touch to it. But, you know...
They formed that up with a, did they not, they had a, this, they had coloured guards, did they?
Yes.
Guarding key points.
Yes, they did.
Yes.
And they were supervised by whites.
Yes. So it was a bit like a sort of private enterprise Ministry of Defence Guard Force.
Exactly, yeah. And you had to get, clearance certificates, you know, on security on your chaps, and the other thing is they had to have a certain level of training, which was checked out by the army army training team.
But should we just finish off with the? Did you injure your legs then in the South African army?
No, it was when I came out. I injured it with my legs with Coin Security.
Oh, okay. So what was the end of your service in the Pathfinder Battalion, the Pathfinder Company?
I'll tell you what happened. I promised myself to do three things before I came out. One. Mm. was to go and get myself involved in my contact
right.
in Angola. Two was to do an operational jump.
Yeah.
And three was to jump on my last day in the army.
Yes.
And what happened is I did an op jump into Angola, and I smashed my legs fairly badly. But you know, it wasn't. I could walk, but the pain was excruciating.
That was just before the incident with the landmine. Yeah.
And that's how I came to be Kazivite. And then I came back, and as I say, I had my contact. And my next thing was to jump in the last day in the army, and it was funny. And fate must have been telling me something. I finished off by running a Pathfinder course just prior to leaving the army. And, you know, I watched straight up to my last day in the army. I said, I'm not going to wind down. And on the last day of the course, I put a parachute on. And I jumped from an aeroplane over a place called Speskop in Pretoria. It was where the Special Forces are stationed, and they had a little drop zone there. And I came out, and I pulled my ripcord, and nothing happened. And I sort of bashed the back of my pack because I thought I was getting a hang up. I bashed it, and then I sort of started moving from side to side to unleash it. And then as I came in to pull my reserve parachute, the chute just ballooned open. It was a beautiful, soft opening. It was, it was one of the better ones I've had.
But that was before, luckily, before you opened
the... owned the reserve.
Yeah.
And I came down, and I landed, and I said, give me another parachute. And I was an aircraft taking on, I got in the aircraft and did another jump. And that was my last day in the army. And it was just, it was an anti-climax. I felt I was doing wrong by coming out, you know.
Did you really?
I wasn't comfortable coming out. But, you know, I just couldn't resist this challenge.
Yeah. Where were you stationed then in during your time in the South African Defence Force?
Right. I was stationed at a place called... It was called Murray Hill, but in actual fact, it was Pete Joubert's. It was his old farm.
Where is the nearest town to the... Because you said that you're up originally near the Rhodesian Zimbabwe border.
No,
then you're in the Drakensbergs.
Yeah.
And then you're at this place in the Transvaal.
The actual base was in Transvaal, just north of Pretoria. Pretoria, and the nearest place was a black township called Hammanskraal.
Right.
Where a Scotsman had a kraal there and just took on the name.
So it's half what distance from Pretoria?
It was 48 k's from Pretoria.
And in which, north-south?
Dead
north.
Yes.
Right. Okay. And then when you're in Namibia?
Yeah. We were in Namibia, we were stationed at a place called Ojakati.
Ojakati, yes.
And another place called Ondangwa. You know, the two, one was the actual military headquarters, and the other was the airfield where we were normally stationed.
Right.
Which was on Dangwa.
Ojakati.
Oshakati.
Osha. O-S-H-A-K-A-T-I.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And the other place was on Dangwa.
On Dangwa. Okay. What was the... You were Kazivite after you'd injured your legs.
Yeah.
What briefly happened in that between then and the end of your service?
What happened is I came back from Southwest Africa. I came from out from Angola to Southwest Africa. I spent a few days there, and I came back down to the Republic. And I spent about a month in the Republic. My legs started coming right. I'd torn ligaments and whatnot. And I ran this Pathfinder course, you know, in the last days of it.
Mm. What was the syllabus of that?
Syllabus was pathfinding, you know, actually, you know, how to mark a drop zone, how to bring in, you know, battalions, like, you know, using beacons and aim off points. And the other thing was...
For wind. Yeah.
And the other was to do it with smoke and with fires, you know. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting little course.
Mm.
And
how long did that last? How long did the course last?
A month, yeah.
1 month, And how many people would you put through that?
It was 23 I put through in the last one.
And were those all foreigners?
No, by that time.
All right.
It was the Pathfinders from one parachute battalion I was training, who had come up to 44 to do the course, yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay, and that was your last end of that.
Yeah.
Where did you go on leave then? Or where you were married at that time, was your wife living then?
She was living in Pretoria.
In Pretoria, yeah. Right. And so you went back on home in Pretoria. Yes. Yeah.
We lived in little beautiful married quarters there. They were mobile homes, but they were beautiful. In actual fact, we moved into them and they were brand new. So we were fairly spoiled people.
Were the foreigners kept separate to the rest of the SADF, even in the married quarters?
Yes, they were, because everybody in the married quarters was a foreigner.
All right.
And I think, in actual fact, the project to bring foreigners in was called Project Bierman. I think it means cousin or neighbour or something. Mm-hmm. And they brought us in, and in fairness to the Afrikaner, or the South African, they tried to integrate us into the army. And they couldn't understand why a soldier could be 10 years in the army and only be a corporal. By his reckoning, that guy should be pushing sergeant major or be a sergeant major. And the whole streaming of people was different. So there was a lack of understanding there, and they'd never had a fully regular army. There was that, and they had an awful lot of, they're a fairly disciplined race by nature, and they couldn't understand lapses in discipline. They couldn't, a lot of it was to do with sense of humour as well. It was totally different from the people who were in the company. They will tell you one thing, but I can tell you another. Can you see it? I could see a side that they couldn't see. Mm. And what it was it was a result. It was probably like the British Army of the 50s. It was the sausage machine was working, and the sausages were being churned down the other side. And they're like they've been run off an assembly line. Yeah. Whereas a lot of the Pathfinders, they were separate entities. They were people with an identity. Yeah. And the last thing I ever wanted to do was to take that away from them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. What did you mix much really with the rest of the army or the South African population?
No, no, we didn't. Mm. We did not. I did. I was fairly popular among them in that I wouldn't at first if I'd have sort of backed down to every confrontation I had with them, I could have been, termed as a wimp or something. But I always used to stand my ground. Mm-hmm. For example, one guy there called me a salt peel.
Oh yes,
one day, mm. And it means 1 foot in England, 1 foot in Africa, and your balls in the ocean. Mm. And I said to him, I said, we were fighting the English long before you even thought about it. Mm. The difference between us and you is we beat them, you didn't.
And how did you say that?
They were fairly good about it. Plus, in fact, as I think where I got on with them, I was interested in history.
Oh yes, so you said previously. Did you meet many the local population that weren't military?
Yeah, I used to meet them at church. My wife was a church-going person. Right. I used to go with them. I met quite a few of them. Mm. And,
what? I mean, it is important. Were they the Dutch Reform, or who were they?
No. The Dutch Reform. They were something else. They took their faith very seriously. Mm. As I say, my missus was Church of England. I was a Catholic.
And yeah.
I used to go along there. And we'd meet people at the church.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. What were the conditions like? Did you get pay, leave, perks, discounts, train warrants, whatever it might
be? No, the South African Army was good to us. You had a 500, on a 1 year contract, they were given 500 rand on enlistment and 1500 rand at the end of the contract. And there was also a month's leave included in that. So the conditions we were given were good. Mm. And the rank we were given, there was none of this, you've got to prove yourself. They said, what rank were you? And we'll match that rank. So there was an awful lot of trying on their part, And there was an awful lot of... what happened was a lot of the professional soldiers left the Rhodesian Army where we were recruited from. And what happened was a lot of flotsam and jetsam got in there as well. And they were using the SADF, as a one-year job in order to get a residence permit and move on to something else. So, there was no commitment on their part. Mm. And I think the South African picked this up.
Was the recruiting at that time, if you walked into... Yeah. Was there a special form of recruiting? Because I was under the impression if you walked into the recruiting office in the centre of Pretoria or the centre of of Cape Town.
Yeah.
That they'd just say, well, if you're not South African, you can't actually join the South African armed forces.
No, what actually happened, in Project Neighbour, or Bierman as they called it, there was a special group handled it in Pretoria, and what happened is some foreigners slipped in through the side door, like guys who'd come out from England and hadn't come from South Africa, or chaps who'd, it was a case of four Italians who'd come out there and joined up. So there was,
it was
that.
Was it only known to those people in Pretoria?
Yes.
But what about the ordinary recruiting officers?
No, they weren't. We had a unit in Hall, a place called Hallmark Building, where you went to and you were processed through there.
Where was that called?
Hallmark Building.
Right in the centre of Pretoria.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you were talking about the citizen force got
getting
called up and so forth, and some were English-speaking and others were Afrikaners. And the citizen force is like a sort of...
TA.
How did that... just tell us, how that went.
Well, one of the things there is, what a lot of people don't understand was the level of commitment of the South African soldier. He did 2 years national service, and that was put aside, and he had to do a further years, ten years of call-ups, which was a month, 1 year, sometimes two or three, then the next year, which averaged 2 months a year sometimes for these guys. And as I say, these people had come through the parachute school at Bloemfontein, and they were sort of grouped, like you'd a grouping for Transvaal and Orange Free State, and a grouping for the Cape, and for Natal. And you could see the difference in the actual chaps, whereas, the Afrikaner was, very Germanic in his discipline, and you could see the sort of English speakers, they could eye up the situation quicker. I'm not saying they were better soldiers here, but, if you got in a camp and you were setting up a camp somewhere, the English-speaking chaps would be away and have something sorted out. Well, the Afrikaner would, he was normally directed and told what to do. And an awful lot of cases, it never created any hostilities between them. But, what it did do is that the English-speaking guys always seemed to have the edge on them when it came to getting the goodies,
Right,
They were sort of faster moving on them.
They were in fact they were reservists, as opposed to they used to have a commando, which was a TA home defence.
If you're over a certain age, you would then get transferred to the commando, which was a localised units that defended their own areas, and they were familiar with the area, so that, consequently they defended them.
Did you have any dealings with the South SAP South African Police?
We built in the army. I never, but later on I did. Yeah.
Oh, maybe we could. I thought the railways and harbour police were quite active in Namibia.
What you've got to watch here is the railway police.
It's been disbanded since, I believe.
In actual fact, in South Africa, you weren't allowed to wear camouflage, but the riot police and the railway police wore it. And the railway police had this sort of very romantic-looking camouflage, sort of based on the old French lizard pattern. And, they were made into SWAT teams. Why railway police should form SWAT teams, I don't know. And, all you've got to do is look at their performance at the Silverton Bank siege. And, where they shot a lot of the hostages. They actually stormed the place. And the intention was there.
When was that?
I think it was 79.
Uh-huh.
79, 80. The intention was there to be good. It's just that, as I say, with the whole country getting mobilised, we just couldn't move fast enough with the training.
Why were they eventually disbanded, or what happened to them? I couldn't actually tell you that.
No,
that was much later in the day. Yeah.
And then what happened with the riot police? They took their camouflage off them, and they moved them into blue fatigues after that.
Right. Okay, we're nearly finished.